Our last oral argument this morning is in A24-0284, Eagles Landing Owners Association versus Philip Cleary. As you're all getting settled, I'll just remind everyone that the appellants have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes. And then finally, the appellants will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So after you get settled, just approach the microphone and the podium goes up and down, and just begin by telling us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Brendan Kenny, and I am counsel for appellants Philip Cleary and Rebecca Cleary. This is a case about a homeowners association that built its foundation on sand. It isn't about what the Clearys did or didn't do before, during, or after they purchased the property. It's about what the homeowners association didn't do. And that's why the district court's order granting summary judgment in favor of Eagles Landing should be reversed for two reasons. First, the membership dues obligation that the breach of contract claim is based on. Eagles Landing had no right to impose that on the Clearys' property because that right didn't exist at the time. The property was initially transferred to a third party in 1993, and nothing happened after that point to change it. Two, the covenants, the restricted covenants that the Clearys' property were subject to were extinguished either in 2008 or 2023, and that means that the district court's order granting summary judgment on the declaratory relief claims of the Clearys must be rejected. Two things to note before I start get into the body of this is that on page 12 of the reply, there should have been a full sentence when we were talking about Nebraska brief, a beef, that case. The sentence broke off, so it read, the Eighth Circuit affirms summary judgment for the bank because, and it broke off then, it should have ended, Nebraska Beef accepted the bank's offer to allow over advances by continuing to access the over advances. And the second part is, in our opening brief, we had language suggesting that the membership dues obligation came from covenants and the bylaws, and this is incorrect. They came only from the bylaws.
So can I ask you about that? I mean, your counterpart makes the argument in their brief that the fees issue, as you're just pointing out, has really only to do with the bylaws and not with the covenants. But and if I'm understanding, part of the issue that you are raising on appeal is that the district court erred in granting summary judgment as to the covenants because of the concern your clients have about the title, the clear title to the property, and that these covenants should not be considered to be, and that's why you're part of the, or clouding the title in any way, and that's why you've asked for us to reverse the district court on that as well. But it's this totally separate issue from the fees. Like even if we disagree with you on the covenants issue, you still have a separate argument as to the fees relating to the bylaws. Am I right about that?
That is correct, Your Honor. So the covenants is focused, the basis for the covenants is that they were extinguished. And so the declaratory relief counterclaim of my clients is that going forward, the restrictive covenants aren't enforceable against them, which you're correct, is a separate argument from the membership dues obligation.
I noticed that in your moving papers below in Exhibit H to your motion for summary judgment, you characterized the bylaws as including that handwritten piece of paper. I think it's on page 11 of the bylaws. We shouldn't read that as a concession that the identification of Lot 30, Block 1 is necessarily then therefore included in the bylaws. Can you explain a little bit about that? I mean, it was your client's declaration that said these are the bylaws. There's some issue in the record about whether or not there was an amendment that was voted on and that you know, became part of the bylaws. Can you address that?
Certainly, Your Honor. And certainly, I think it's fair to say that below there were a lot of moving parts and a lot of arguments going back and forth that kind of consolidated at the district court and hopefully are presented to this court in a little clearer form. So what it comes down to, so in the addendum ADD023 is, I believe, the page you're talking about, and you see on the front of it filed and recorded on 5/9/2006. So that was when the bylaws were filed and recorded, which is the kind of the starting clock for the bylaws being applicable. And so this first page does contain handwritten notes about apparently listing what is there and what is covered by it. And on appeal, and I think for the first time, Eagles Landing makes the argument that this is something like solving maybe a Scrivener's error in the bylaws, but there's nothing in the record, nothing showing that there's been an amendment to the bylaws that cures the problem that is undisputed, that when the bylaws on page ADD 024 talk about a lot in Eagles Landing first edition or plat of any future adjacent developments, that does not include the Cleary's property.
Right. I mean, it doesn't even say, even the section that mentions lots 1 to 33, it's difficult to tell from the way it's written, but it appears to be a list that ends with the designation Eagles Landing, not Eagles Landing First Edition.
Correct. And if you go down one, you see Eagles Landing First Edition, and that says lots 1 to 6.
Right.
Block one.
But I mean, this document in and of itself doesn't really say when it was, what it is exactly, and how it's to be interpreted with regard to Article 2.2 regarding the membership provision.
Correct, Your Honor. And that's really the underlying, one of the problems, not the only problem, but one of the problems with the argument that this applies to the Cleary's. The other problem is that you step over that for a moment, and then you get their argument, and it seems like it's a necessary argument for their position, because if you look at the transcript from the summary judgment motion on 11 to 12, they say that just getting these bylaws isn't enough. There has to be a written contract or an acquiescence by the lot owners for it to be applicable. So we don't have the written contract. They seem to say is the PUD. I'm forgetting the next word that comes after it, but it's the mortgage document.
Rider.
Yes, rider. Sorry, thank you, Your Honor. And that rider document says that the borrower, the Cleary's, needs to abide by the governing documents as applicable to them. Well, it doesn't change how it doesn't give the governing documents something they don't have. There's these, you know, these bundle of rights that exist. It doesn't put that stick in there, the ability to impose membership dues obligations on the Cleary's property. And
the dues come from the bylaws. If, assuming that Eagles Landing is included, the dues are listed in the bylaws.
Correct, Your Honor.
But what do you do with the fact that the articles of incorporation include Eagles Landing? Includes Eagles Landing First Edition. I mean, that's within the Article 2, Paragraph A. So, jumping forward to the ratification and unilateral contract argument, I mean, to the extent that the PUD directs your clients to be aware of what the constituent documents are that would include the Articles of Incorporation, which includes Eagles Landing, why shouldn't we view there to be enough in the record that there's no genuine issue of material fact that a unilateral contract was ratified by virtue of notice that Eagles Landing is part of the association as listed in the Articles of Incorporation? There are benefits in the association that are given as consideration to your clients, and they're paying these fees. That's undisputed. They paid it a couple times, or a few times. Why shouldn't we affirm on that basis?
Well, again, you know, not only there is a reference, a broader reference to the to Eagle's Landing in the Articles of Incorporation, as there is to the plat in general in the covenants. That's why we don't dispute that the covenants when the developer transferred the interest in the Cleary's property to a third party in 1993, they were subject to the covenants. We're saying that we're not subject to now because they're extinguished. But that didn't give the homeowners association a stick they didn't already have. They had to do something to get it. And the Articles of Incorporation, describing Eagle's Landing as a broader thing than it is in the bylaws when it comes to the membership dues obligation, does not take the stick away and give it back to the homeowners association. And that's the problem with once you get past the PUD.
I mean, that's if you're construing it. I think if you construe the documents narrowly, which, you know, there, I think you have a strong argument about that. But, you know, I think when people step back from this, your clients are living in this, so they're getting benefits from what the HOA does, and they're not paying. And there's notice here that they're in the Articles of Incorporation, that this is an association that includes the plat of Eagle's Landing. If we agree with you on your CIC argument and on everything about your interpretation of the documents, why shouldn't we affirm on the basis of this unilateral contract theory and the ratification of it?
Well, Your Honor, putting all the rest aside, looking at the unilateral contract acquisition, kind of the equitable argument, I think a case is the best kind of example to look at, and it's also cited by the other side, and that's Nebraska Beef. So in Nebraska Beef, that Eighth Circuit case, you have a bank that has a contract with a customer, and as part of that, they say, hey, we have this over advances policy that you're usually not able to do. We're going to let you do it. We're going to have a fee. And the customer keeps doing it, and the fee gets attached. What the argument here that's different is that the actual agreement that would provide for something like that was the PUD, was that rider, and that was, insofar as it could do that, the rider wasn't between the Eagle's Landing and the Clearys. It was between the mortgage company and the Clearys. So what there isn't is legal authority that shows that you can take one of those.
But you wouldn't be contesting. I don't understand that, though, because if the bylaws were really clear and said Eagle's Landing, say the bylaws included Eagle's Landing and actually were specific and said, you know, lot 30, block 1 in the bylaws. Would you still be arguing that the PUD was not enough? I mean, what would your position then be? I mean, I think the idea behind the unilateral contract theory is that there's enough notice when the PUD says you got to abide by these constituent documents, and now there are services being provided by the HOA to your clients, and they're not paying for it. So why, I guess, what's the difference?
Well, the argument would certainly be stronger for Eagle's Landing if it were the case that the Clearys property was added.
And the PUD would still be between the bank initially.
Correct.
And your client. Right?
I think it still doesn't get them there, and that's, I think, why they acknowledge, as I said, on pages 11 to 12 of their summary judgment argument, that you need more than just the bylaws. You need a written contract or acquiescence. And I don't think we don't get there on acquiescence without something, some vis-a-vis between Eagle's Landing and the Clearys. So really, what we come down to is that there is not what the Clearys did or didn't do, but what Eagle's Landing didn't do. and that was at the beginning there there was no members' dues obligation duty to transfer when the initial transfer happened in 1993. The Phillips the Clearidge property didn't become part of the of the Eagles Landing for the purpose of the bylaws and imposing the membership dues requirement, and then nothing happened after that to change it. And finally, with the covenants, a separate argument with the covenants that either under the Articles of Incorporation or the 30-year rule, they're extinguished.
Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. You will have time for rebuttal. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Saunders, and I represent Eagles Landing Owners Association, the respondent in this matter. This matter arose out of a conciliation court order, which was appealed, and involves the less than $200 a year association fees of Eagles Landing and the attempt by the association to collect that. And as Your Honor has suggested, kind of took my thunder away, I look at the Articles of Incorporation, and they do include Eagles Landing, just as you've indicated. It's clearly a Scrivener's error. As we look at some of these documents done in 1993, we all wish they would some of them would have been done differently. But to make the argument of counsel is that a unilateral contract requires a clear promise, and the PUD provides that. We get way beyond the notice issue to the appellant because the PUD says there are some obligations you have, and if you don't do them, you're going to default on your mortgage.
But there's a little bit of an issue of fact there, right? I mean, for this to be resolved at summary judgment, I mean, there's a tension between the Articles of Incorporation and the bylaws, and it doesn't look to me like this issue was fully considered by the district court in the district court's order. And on top of that, I think you're hard pressed in some ways to claim Scrivener's error when twice in the membership provision of the bylaws it refers specifically to Eagles Landing First Edition and not Eagles Landing. So I mean, why is this appropriate to affirm on summary judgment given that?
Yeah. Interestingly, Your Honor, I don't know that issue, the specific one raised in appeal, was addressed so that there would be a question of fact. The handwritten items were written by the recorder's office saying that these bylaws were filed in 2006 against this property.
Well, the handwritten sheet doesn't say that. It just lists a bunch of lot numbers and describes lots 1 through 33 as being Eagles Landing and doesn't say, I mean, it sure would be nice if it said we're amending the membership provision of the bylaws to extend it to lot 30, block 1, right? But it doesn't.
And I have to be clear of what I just said. What I'm suggesting is if you looked up that lot in the real estate records, it would show that these bylaws are filed against it. And so what is suggested by the appellant is that had they raised that objection when they bought the property, that's why we discussed a little bit at summary judgment what a title commitment is and whether you're requesting. So to make their argument better, Your Honor, they would have had to say at the time before they bought the property, they would have said, you know what? We looked at the bylaws, and we see it doesn't apply to us, and yet you've recorded the bylaws against our property. We're not going to buy this unless you remove those bylaws from us. But they didn't, Your Honor. In much the same way they went to the meetings, they paid the dues, they get the benefits, and they never objected. Had they objected at the start, if the Clearys sell this property tomorrow to a new person and tell them, hey, you should object to these items and have them removed, maybe that would be a proper argument. But
on the other hand, what if they just looked at the constituent documents and concluded, well, this doesn't apply to us, you know. Lot 30 is not within Eagles Landing First Edition, and you know, I mean, I understand that they went to the meetings and They may or may not have voted. I don't know if that's totally clear from the record or what the votes were, but the bylaws certainly don't seem to indicate that they had the right to vote, right? I mean, it only was for members that lived in Eagles Landing first edition and subsequent or new properties, right?
Right. And the question, and I think it was raised by you before, is this would be a title objection, right? And if you're going to accept property with a PUD rider on your mortgage that says if you violate these, you're defaulting on your mortgage, wouldn't it have been incumbent upon them at that time to go and say, I'm not going to sign the mortgage. I don't want to receive this property unless you remove this cloud.
The response to that is, well, I don't have to worry about that. I'm not in default because I never have to pay these things. I mean, isn't that what they're saying?
And that would have been a good thing to say before they went and paid the 2 years of association dues and participated.
You know, and that might be a wonderful argument at trial to say, you know, this is all fascinating, what was and was not in the documents. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is they paid them. These arguments are waived. You lose. But that's for trial, mm-hmm. where you can, you know, cross-examine them and, you know, well, why did you pay? If you never had to owe this, why are you paying them? And, you know, they'd come up with some answer. And, you know, the jury would make the credibility determinations. But, again, following up on Judge Eade's questions, I mean, this seems like a lot of assumptions that we're making on summary judgment and inferences, or that the district court made and that we're supposed to affirm against the person who is opposing summary judgment. And that's the one thing we're never allowed to do. I mean, all these inferences may be valid, but we're not allowed to make them at this particular posture of the case. Isn't that right?
It's true, unless you look at this as a unilateral contract. And that requires a definite offer. And the offer was, if you want the benefits of this home association, you need to pay for it. The offer was accepted by their payments, which there's no question of fact on that. And there must be consideration, and the consideration is having your grass mowed, having the sign maintained, having an association which keeps the grounds. And so on summary judgment, the three elements of a unilateral contract were found by the court through, and there's no dispute
about
that.
And when was the offer made?
At the point where the bylaws were part of the Cleary's title, and they knew it was there, and then they participated in that. The offer was clear.
We have the abstract of title in the record, right? I mean, do we have the abstract of title in the record here showing that clearly? I mean, we have the... Is that in the record?
It is not, Your Honor.
Right, so, I mean... And the problem is the tension, right, between the articles of incorporation, even if you're going to try to argue that, and the bylaws, right? I mean, it's not totally clear we would have to be making an assumption and making a factual finding that was sufficient notice for them to know that this was an offer that they were accepting through the PUD, right?
Well, I guess I look at it differently, that the PUD and the fact that they signed the mortgage with that rider is an acknowledgement that they believe they were obligated pursuant to those bylaws.
But what your counterpart argued earlier is that the language of the PUD, it doesn't state what the obligations are. It just says you're required to comply with the obligations. You still have to have an obligation. And if there's not a clear obligation in the constituent documents, then how is this an appropriate determination for summary judgment?
Well, I believe that there was. If you sign a PUD and you have the bylaws that are referenced in your title, and I think it's clear from the addendum that it was recorded on May 9th, 2006, and included the Cleary's property, then I believe that is evidence that you understood your obligations, which was finalized by your payment of the dues for 2 years. Why did they pay the dues, the question would be, and I think the trial court believed, why would I pay the dues if I didn't think they applied to me, which is your argument, is they don't apply. If I looked at that, I'd say, well, they don't apply to me. Well, then don't go to the meetings, don't pay the dues, and don't accept the benefits.
Well, I think that was the Frank case out of Utah. that you cited in your brief, I mean, that it's persuasive in that regard, but in Frank, it seems to have been undisputed that the lots were within the boundaries of the homeowners association. And so I don't know that that's an undisputed fact here, and there may be a genuine issue of material fact as to whether or not, particularly with the way the bylaws are written, right? I mean, and again, you, as Judge Connolly pointed out, these sound like very strong arguments for a jury in support of a unilateral contract theory, but I guess I would like to hear more about why it's appropriate for affirmance at a summary judgment stage.
Your Honor, I would point you to the addendum at 019, which is the Articles of Incorporation, when it says, to be and constitute the Association of Lot Owners of the Plat of Eagles Landing First Edition, and such other and further development adjacent and contiguous to the Plat of Eagles Landing in the future. That's the Articles of Incorporation of the Eagles Landing Owners Association.
Right, but then the members in Article 3, it says the members of this corporation shall be those persons as described in the bylaws. I mean, and then the bylaws don't include Eagles Landing.
And if I was going to trial and try to find the evidence to prove that it was a Scrivener's error, I would point to the obvious ambiguity that's been created here. And I'm not sure how I don't know who I would call to testify. Raymond Wechter's deceased. He was the person who drafted the document. I suppose I could prove that, which I know, but I live in Wilmer, Mr. Kuzman, who signed the bylaws, was in the original plat of Eagles Landing. And so, but, you know, I'm not sure, although it creates maybe a scintilla of question of fact, I'm not sure how I would have or would, if this was remanded for trial, present evidence that would prove that it's a Scrivener's error when it seems clear on its face that, and kind of unbelievable that they would have bylaws for Eagles Landing which would not include the original plat. There's been no evidence provided by the appellant that there's any reason that would have happened in the world, that we would have an original plat, a first edition, and subsequent editions, but in the bylaws done in 1994, we would have excluded the original plat. It seems like a good argument at the Court of Appeals, but realistically, I'm not sure that it makes sense in light of the documents.
Can I ask you a question? I think it's at the end of your brief. Court should enter judgment in favor of plaintiff and against defendants for $9,712.57 plus additional attorney's fees and costs. Was that taken from your trial court papers? Because you didn't appeal, I know the court didn't award attorney's fees, right? And you didn't appeal that, and there's no motion for appellate attorney's fees pending. Am I wrong about this? Or
looks like a copy and paste error, Your Honor. I think we're limited to the $500 and some judgment of the trial court.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
That's all right.
Apologize. If there's no further questions, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. Mr. Kenny, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You're welcome.
If we could sum up a lot of what's been discussed today by Eagles Landing, is there's a lot of credibility issues that could come up, and we have, when we talked about a scintilla of evidence, well, we have kind of a scintilla of evidence supporting this Scrivener's error, that you have this page that is connected seemingly with the bylaws in some way because it's stamped by the recorder, and it has who appears to be someone below it. I think it says David Hisner, someone who appears to be connected with the homeowners association, who maybe filled this out, but certainly no change or or anything that would show that there was an amendment or something. And again, the differences between Article 2 and Article 3, and this just goes to the problem the challenge that everyone has here, that Eagles Landing in many ways, with the membership dues obligation, they built their foundation on sand. There's a lot of talk about what the Clery should or shouldn't have done or what they were thinking. Well, in this case, the governing documents were done willy-nilly over time, and that created problems. And they didn't solve the problems the way they could have taken action to. And so we have the tension between the Articles of Incorporation, as Your Honor noted, showing that there's a difference in terms of the area of Eagles Landing and who the members are and who are held to it. And there's a lot of different things that could be said that aren't in the record about why the Clerys did what they did and when they did it. And that's exactly the sort of factual issue and credibility issue and damages issue for the jury to determine. And I'm sure there are a lot of questions that could be asked. There's a lot of questions that could be asked on our side of what the Homeowners Association was thinking when they did this.
Was there discovery taken before summary judgment in this case? Was
Your Honor, I. You're going to hate this statement that a lawyer makes, that I wasn't directly working on the case below, but I don't believe there was a whole lot other than your initial disclosures. I don't think there was a depositions taken, and if I'm wrong, I apologize for missing that. So yes, this is a case of not a whole lot of discovery by any means. And I should just add, really, the best case for them in terms of persuasiveness is the Frank case, which is in Utah. And in that case, again, the issue was authority. We don't challenge that a homeowners association that does the right thing and does it the right way would have the authority to impose a membership dues obligation on lot owners if they did it the right way. And that's just that's not what is possible here. So we have arguments that the Clerys, the reasons they did things or didn't pay or when they paid weren't credible. And Your Honor, when you raise the matter of this unilateral contract, when was there the things you need for a unilateral contract? When was there acceptance? When was there this meeting of the minds? When was there all this? Well, and apparently the answer seemed to be it happened when they signed the PUD and after. So which is it? How does this even work? So in the end, we kind of come back to where we are at the beginning. We have a homeowners association that started things out by not going through the right actions they needed to impose a membership dues obligation on the Clerys, and they're what happened when the bylaws were recorded and in the PUD agreement that the Clerys signed and in their payment of dues for 2 years afterwards doesn't change the fact that the stick in the bundle of sticks that the Homeowners Association has, the one to impose a membership dues obligation on the Clerys never arrived. In addition, the covenants are extinguished because within the Articles of Incorporation, they would be after 15 years unless they were renewed beforehand, which they weren't, and under the 30-year rule in Minnesota Statute Section 520.22, I believe, it is extinguished. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kenney. Thank you, Mr. Saunders. The matter is submitted. That being our last oral argument of the day, we are adjourned.